I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama rejected the hotly contested plan to build a pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas on the Gulf Coast. The president said that his administration wasn't given sufficient time to review the project. The pipeline developer TransCanada Corporation has indicated that it will reapply for a new application. We're going to debate the Keystone XL pipeline, but first, Matthew Wall joined us to talk about the Obama administration energy policy as laid out in last week's State of the Union address. Interestingly, Mr. Obama made no mention of the pipeline in that address. Wald is a reporter for the New York Times, where he's been writing about energy for 30 years. And Matthew Wald, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
How would you describe the president's energy policy? Is there a sentence, a soundbite, a bumper sticker that would describe it?
It's politically shrewd and slightly less conventional and slightly cleaner than his predecessor. I should point out that he didn't reject the Keystone Pipeline. He's trying to delay a decision until after the election because no matter what he does, he'll annoy somebody. But that's in the nature of energy policy. He has been, he's trying to do a triple play here, which is to make cleaner energy sources, which will clean up the environment, reduce global warming, will free us from import dependence, and will stimulate some new industries. But it's tough to pull off this triple play, and we have yet to see whether it's actually going to happen. I think, in the end, his most ambitious idea is to get the electric car business running, because that'll do all three. It'll reduce our balance of payments problem for imported oil. It'll reduce getting oil from places that don't like us, as the cliche goes.
Right.
And it'll be conventionally cleaner and could give the U.S. a new industry to dominate, but we've got a lot of money tied up in this. At this instant, it's not happening yet, but we'll see what happens.
Do you think that the fact that the president did not make any mention of the pipeline last week is that it's just an issue that is too hot to handle for him and for his party?
Yes, that would be about right. There's no political advantage to doing it. There is, on the other hand, political advantage. He said, for example, that he wants the Pentagon to buy 1 gigawatt worth of renewable electricity equipment, mostly, I would imagine, wind with some solar, at a time when some of the federal tax incentives for wind and sun are coming up for expiration, especially on the wind side. That's something he might be able to pull off that would be a big help to an industry that he and the Democrats and a lot of voters of both parties favor.
Do you think it's easier to get the military to sign on than private enterprise?
Well, the military is a big customer. The federal government has always used its role as customer to encourage various things. He's also using the military to encourage alternative fuels, you know, naval ships and jet planes to run on fuels made from biomass that are not commercially viable, but if you prime the pump a little bit, if you create a market, maybe enough researchers will work hard enough to find something that will eventually compete on a pure commercial basis with oil.
And the military is, even if they cut some of the military is a big market.
The military is a huge consumer of energy. We were lucky in the Persian Gulf Wars to be working out of Saudi Arabia, which provided a lot of the fuel, but you can imagine the armies don't run exactly on their stomachs these days. They run on their gas tanks, and if you import all your fuel, that's a problem.
Mm. The president did make a pretty strong pitch for natural gas exploration and drilling. I don't think this is new, but
and oil
and oil as well. Yes, go ahead.
In fact, there's some element of favoring everything and favoring competing options. For example, if you're in favor of natural gas, that means and of fracking, that means the price of natural gas will stay lower. If the price of natural gas today were back where it was when he took office, we would not need incentives to get wind and solar out there. They'd be happening just by pure economics. But the the energy picture in this country does not really run according to what the government wants to do. It runs according to international events and technology. We have had this amazing new technological breakthrough. It's not in wind, it's not in sun, it's how to produce natural gas cheaply, and that has changed our energy map. We've also had a change in the world economy that has made oil more expensive. Again, that's not something the U.S. government did. It could lead to changes that the U.S. government could foster where we end up with some alternatives to imported oil, But essentially, the U.S. government is along for the ride, trying to steer the ship through the rapids here, but not determining the flow of the river, if I can mix a metaphor.
You did mix several metaphors, but that's all right, Matthew Wald. But interestingly, the president also, in a sense, took credit or said that the government deserves credit for developing this hydraulic fracturing process used to get natural gas.
That's true. You know, the U.S. Department of Energy has put a little money into absolutely everything, and whatever's out there, the government probably had a role. But the government has put money into 12 of the last two breakthroughs. In other words, we spend a lot of money on things that might work, and occasionally one of them pans out and changes things.
Hydraulic fracturing is a controversial issue when it comes to natural gas drilling, and the Marcellus Shale here in Pennsylvania, of course, has become a contentious issue, pitting several groups against each other. And one of the complaints is that the chemicals used in this hydraulic fracturing is not known to the public. Where does that issue stand?
I don't, to be honest with you, know what chemicals go into a lot of the things I consume. I think there's a lot of uncertainty and fear. I think that extractive industries of all kinds, including drilling, will do only what they're required to do, and that if there's no government scrutiny, then there's no effective control. I strongly suspect it's possible to take steps to really minimize the environmental impact. Every form of energy extraction does damage. Every last one, wind and solar, do some damage. The oil and coal do a lot of damage. You have to pick the net rational thing and do it with as little damage as possible. Fracking is in that category.
The president also talked about oil drilling and developing areas for drilling for oil. And this, of course, is, a year or two after the BP oil spill.
Yes.
Is the country back to drilling oil?
We never stopped. And there are several reasons why you might want to drill for oil. One of them is it's domestic jobs. The second is it helps the balance of payments. The third is, in many cases, the taxpayer owns the oil and earns a royalty on it, and that money flows into the federal treasury and state treasuries. So you got to have a good reason not to want to do it. And, yes, nobody wants more oil spills, and we can debate whether oversight is appropriate and what the prospect for future spills is. I'm sure you and I have not seen our last oil spill. But again, as with fracking, there are probably steps you can take that make bad outcomes less likely.
And that's Matthew Wald, our first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, reporter at the New York Times. He's been writing about energy topics for about 30 years now. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You mentioned, and the president talked about renewables, whether solar or wind. And, of course, the critics of the Obama administration talk about Solyndra and how the U.S. government invested in Solyndra and the company went bankrupt. What does Solyndra tell us about renewables?
It tells us something about energy in general, which is the market rules and the government is along for the ride. And what we did was we put a lot of money, we, the taxpayers, into a technology that would have worked well if it had come out 2 or 3 years before it actually did. There's a lot of startup companies out there that invent the better mousetrap, but it's the mousetrap for a mouse that doesn't exist anymore, and that's what Solyndra did. It's not the only company that got loan guarantees that has gone bankrupt, and guess what? There are going to be some others out there. The big one to watch is the loan guarantees for electric cars, in which I'd include batteries for electric cars and drive components for electric cars. If we don't, in fact, develop a market for electric cars, we're going to end up with huge oversupply, as we've got now in the solar field. We've got an oversupply in solar. This is what killed Solyndra, because the European market didn't expand as expected. The recession slowed all this down, and the Chinese are building like mad. That could happen in other areas where we've used loan programs similar to the one for Solyndra.
But is there oversupply because there's not enough demand?
Well, yeah, oversupply is always a mixture of supply and demand.
Right.
Supply went up, demand went down, and the price crashed. The price of a solar cell has never really correlated with the price to produce it. It's always correlated with the market. And there are times when they were getting cheaper and cheaper to produce, but demand was still strong, prices stayed high, people in that business made a lot of money. At this moment, we're in the opposite situation, which is prices are really weak. Production prices have declined a bit, but people are getting squeezed.
But we're also seeing China and other countries, Germany, moving ahead on some of these renewable energy forms.
This is true, but the European market for solar is not expanding quite as fast as people thought it would, and the reason is, you know, Europe has its own economic problems, and I think in some places they were getting saturated with solar, and they just slowed up a bit, and their incentives became less generous. People were, the Chinese and we were building factories as if demand would expand exponentially forever. And we're having a market adjustment, and Solyndra got killed in the crossfire here.
And what about the role of nuclear? How does the administration see that, and where does that technology stand today?
This is a very good example of the limits of government power. When President Obama came into office, there was a 2005 act already on the books that provided $17.5 billion in loan guarantees. And President Obama and many Democrats and many Republicans said, it's not enough, let's triple that. They haven't actually gotten to triple it, but they said, let's triple it. Guess what? They haven't been able to give out the $17.5 billion because so few people want to build reactors right now. The reason few people want to build reactors is not Fukushima, it's not nuclear waste, those are both concerns, but the real issue is natural gas is so cheap that it's very difficult to compete with right now. You don't want to build a reactor that's going to turn out electricity at, pick a number, 10 cents a kilowatt hour, when you can buy a natural gas machine and turn it out right now for 3 or 4 cents a kilowatt hour. These are approximate numbers. If you build the reactor, you're taking a long-term bet. The reactor is going to be with us for 40, 60 years, maybe 80 years. What is the price of natural gas going to be over the next 80 years? Will there be carbon charges? How strong will the demand for electricity be in this country in 2020? In 2030, in 2050. This is a risky investment.
And final question to you, Matthew Wald. When we talk about energy, are we talking, is it important to think of it as a global market versus a domestic market?
Depends what form of energy you're talking about. Oil is global. If we drill more here, it won't bring down the price. It'll just bring down the amount we have to invest. The amount we have to import. Natural gas at the moment is mostly a North American market. We might hook into the world market by beginning to export it, which is a development that was unthought of a few years ago. Electricity is mostly a regional or local market because our transmission system is fairly primitive.
Well, on that note, thank you for getting us started. And Matthew Wald, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. You're welcome. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He's been writing about energy for some 30 years now. In a sense, getting our conversation started. And coming up, we're going to debate the Keystone XL pipeline. We have two guests waiting in the wings, and we'll be taking your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase has posted 5-year survival rates for major cancers on its website. Survival rates at Fox Chase are compared to those at community hospitals across the nation. This is but one measure of quality to help you make decisions about cancer care. At Fox Chase, compassionate care is much more than a number. It's part of their mission to prevail over cancer. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the winter membership campaign, and I want you to become a member of WHYY. Why? Because we depend on listeners just like you to support the programs that you enjoy. It's just that simple. This year is going to be a busy one, and our job is to keep you informed about the news and provide in-depth analysis of the issues and the controversies. That's why you listen, and that's why we need your support. That phone number, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, a Philadelphia Orchestra showpiece, Rimsky-Korsakov's spectacular Scheherazade, under guest conductor Nicola Luisotti, plus Shostakovich's first violin concerto with Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg. For your tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorc.org. this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Scheherazade with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The search for oil in this country has pitted jobs against the environment, and Exhibit A for that conflict is the plan for the Keystone XL pipeline to transport oil from the tar sands in Canada to refineries in Texas on the Gulf Coast. President Obama rejected/delayed a decision on that proposal, and now it's become a hotly contested issue. Joining us now to debate the pipeline is Susan Casey Lefkowitz. She is the director of the International Program at the National Resources Defense Council and heads the NRDC's opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. And Susan Casey Lefkowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Also with us is Robert Bryce, senior fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute, author of a book called Power Hungry, The Myth of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. Robert Bryce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be with you.
And Robert Bryce, let me begin with you. Why should the XL pipeline be built?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Jobs, reliable flows of energy from our huge neighbor and very close ally to the north, particularly now, given the continuing unrest in the Middle East, it could provide a hedge in terms of reliable supply. It is oil from this hemisphere, and I guess the punchline, if you know, to boil it all down, Marty, is that love oil, hate oil, oil is here to stay. And I think that that's what the opponents of the pipeline have done, and give them credit. They've helped block it now for several months, and the Obama administration is on their side. But the reality is, if oil didn't exist, we would have to invent it, and it is an essential commodity in the modern economy in the United States and around the world.
And I want to pick up on several things that you said, but let me give you, Susan Casey Lefkowitz, a chance to tell us why you and your organization opposes the pipeline construction.
Sure, Marty. Basically, this pipeline that would bring, as you said, tar sands oil from Canada down to the Gulf Coast, mostly for export, a lot of it would be turned into diesel there and sent overseas. It's essentially bringing in a much dirtier form of oil than conventional oil. Tar sands is sort of this gunky form of carbon that eventually can be upgraded and refined into gasoline and diesel, but it starts out needing to be strip mined from under the boreal forest in Canada, pumped at high pressure with higher risk of spills, and then it's harder to clean up once it spills. And so what this pipeline basically is a pipeline that puts American farms and waters at risk, American climate at risk, so that oil companies can get a higher price for tar sands oil on the world market when they export it.
And to you, Robert Bryce, just picking up on what Susan Casey Lefkowitz said about, talking about tar sands oil, that this is dirtier than other forms of oil. What do you say?
Well, look, the world is moving toward unconventional sources of energy, whether it's unconventional natural gas or, in this case, unconventional oil. But I'll go back to the point that I made before. There is this... This is an effective tool, give them credit again, from the NRDC and from the left to demonize the oil industry. It's been ongoing for decades. This isn't new. But let's look at the numbers. And I listened to Mr. Wald earlier, and you asked about what the energy policy of the Obama administration is. He said it's politically shrewd. I would use the word incoherent. This is the single most important single energy project for the United States since the Prudhoe Bay Pipeline. And yet, you rightly pointed out that President Obama did not mention it in the State of the Union at all. He mentioned oil 10 times, but not the pipeline. It's almost as though he's afraid to discuss it. And the critical number here that's lost amidst all this, you know, again, demonization of the oil business, spills, you know, dirty oil, et cetera, this one pipeline, if built, 700,000 barrels a day would provide 46% more energy to the U.S. than all of the solar panels and wind turbines in the country combined.
Well, let me give you a chance, Susan Casey Lefkowitz, to respond to that, that in terms of providing energy, that the pipeline beats renewables.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a pipeline that would provide the U.S. with a lot of risks to our land and water. It's a pipeline that would drive tar sands oil expansion up in Canada, meaning greater risk to our climate. But it's not really meant to supply the U.S. with oil. We actually have enough pipeline capacity to bring all the tar sands that's being produced down to the U.S. to the Midwest right now, and more. This is a pipeline meant to bypass our Midwestern refineries and get this oil to its first major deepwater port from where the oil companies can export it anywhere in the world. So basically, this is not a pipeline to supply the U.S. or for U.S. national security. It's a pipeline so that oil companies can be raising the price of oil, ironically, all across the U.S., as they're getting a higher price for tar sands overseas.
Robert Bryce, let me go back to you.
Sure.
You mentioned the fact that this pipeline would mean jobs. How many jobs are we talking about?
Well, that point is under debate. TransCanada has set up to 20,000, but some of those, of course, would be construction jobs, and they would be temporary. But let's assume it's only, you know, for the sake of discussion, a quarter of that number, 5,000. That's a huge number, particularly for a project that involves no federal taxpayer money. And you talked with Mr. Wald about Solyndra. Just last week we saw the failure of Enter One, the electric vehicle company, or the battery maker for the electric vehicle market. I think what's interesting about this, and I think what is potentially the long-term fallout from this battle over this pipeline, is the split between the environmental groups and labor. And if you listen to what the head of the Laborers International Union of North America said just a few days ago after the Obama administration blocked the pipeline again, he said, and I'm quoting, we're repulsed by some of our supposed brothers and sisters lining up with job killers like the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council. Remember, this has been the Blue-Green Alliance, and his group, that union, just dropped out of that group because of this issue. So I think it is, you know, from a long-term political perspective, I think this indicates or is indicative of what I think is probably the long-term split between the unions and the marriage of convenience, really, between the unions and the environmental groups.
Do you see that Blue-Green split, Susan?
Well, you know, what's interesting when you look at this particular pipeline is it's being held up as though it's somehow a national jobs plan, when really what it is a single pipeline that, of course, will bring construction jobs. The numbers, as Robert pointed out, are somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 construction jobs over 2 years. There might be a few hundred permanent jobs from this pipeline. This is hardly a jobs plan for the United States. And as one would expect, the union that has a lot of construction workers in it has been supportive of the pipeline, whereas a number of other unions, those who are really caring about clean energy, fighting climate change, working in the clean energy transportation industry, they've basically said, we either don't support this pipeline, or at the very least, we stand by the president in his decision to reject this pipeline.
Let me go back to you, Robert Bryson. I'm actually looking at something that was in the New York Times recently, just quoting here. It was just an article about the pipeline. Bipartisan opposition to the pipeline has notably been led by Governor Dave Heineman of Nebraska, a Republican. And I'm not saying it's a partisan issue per se, but, you know, here's the governor of a state where the pipeline is supposed to go through, and he opposes it, or he certainly has concerns about it.
Sure. Well, and I understand that, but recall that the State Department, if memory serves, has done three different assessments of this pipeline and found that the environmental impact would be negligible. There are over 20,000 miles of pipeline that cross the Ogallala Aquifer. So let's be frank, in terms of a PR situation, in terms of how this issue is played out in the public sphere, you're combining two issues about which there is infinite potential for demagoguery, and that is oil and water, and we see it playing out very clearly here. But if I can just make a couple of points here, we hear about this, oh, this is hardly a jobs plan. Well, it seems to me from the left, groups like the NRDC, they promote the idea of job creation as long as it's in what industries that they believe are politically acceptable, the clean energy, green energy, etc. But here we have a huge project, multiple billions of dollars to be spent at no cost to the taxpayer, and suddenly, oh, these jobs don't count. To me, it's inconsistent and really, again, incoherent.
Well, Susan, let me give you a chance to come back at that, and then I'll give out the phone number again, and we'll get some callers in and continue our conversation. Susan Casey Lefkowitz, jobs.
Well, you know, you started out with Governor Heineman in Nebraska, and the concerns of the farmers and ranchers in Nebraska have been very real. That's a place where the Ogallala Aquifer, which is an underground freshwater aquifer that provides fresh water for eight states in the U.S. heartland, it's a place where it bubbles up to the surface in the Nebraska sandhills. And so what's really been a key issue in this pipeline has been whether you take a tar sands oil pipeline, which has a higher likelihood of spilling. In fact, the first Keystone tar sands oil pipeline that was just built 2 years ago by the same company leaked 14 times in the U.S. in its first year, much higher than we expect to see from an oil pipeline in its first year of operation. But what you're basically looking at is a pipeline that would be the first oil pipeline through the sandhills in Nebraska, where the Ogallala Aquifer bubbles up to the surface, and you're looking at putting the water for farmers and ranchers across the heartland at risk of oil spills. That's something that would cost jobs. That's something that would cost the taxpayer a lot of money. In fact, a spill in Michigan from a tar sands pipeline a year and a half ago is still being cleaned up at a pretty high cost to the taxpayer.
And that's Susan Casey Lefkowitz joins us along with Robert Bryce, and we are debating the Keystone XL pipeline. Susan Casey Lefkowitz, director of the International Program at, I should say, the Natural Resources Defense Council, sorry about that, heads up the NRDC's opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. Robert Bryce, senior fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute, has written a book called Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future, and we're taking calls interested in where you stand on this Keystone XL pipeline. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like, Peter from Germantown to join our conversation. And Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think that the concerns about the leaking of the pipeline and whether or not jobs are temporarily or permanent created are certainly issues to be considered, but I think that there's a larger issue which is really not being talked about, not only a little bit on this discussion, not at all by President Obama, and that is the larger picture of the climate cost of the extraction of the tar sands themselves from the boreal forests of Alberta. The extraction of the tar sands basically calls for huge areas of forest to be strip mined, deeply strip mined, with an enormous environmental cost, an atmospheric cost of carbon deposited in the atmosphere in that process. And then on the other end, the refining of it, this is a very low-yielding petroleum product. And the refining of it calls for immense amounts of energy that actually yield a rather low return of the petroleum finally extracted from it for the energy used. James Hansen.
Well, you know what, Peter? Let me take your points because they're good ones, and I want to give first Robert Bryce a chance to weigh in on that. He's talking about the extraction and refinery of this oil.
Well, sure. Okay, so let's take on this issue of CO2. In my view, this idea that somehow if the U.S. doesn't use this oil, we're going to keep that oil in the ground, again, is based on a false assumption. The Canadians are currently holding hearings on a pipeline that would run from Alberta to the West Coast so they can export that same oil to Asia. The idea or the claim, and it is a false one, that if we somehow block this Keystone XL pipeline, that Canada will not develop the oil sands and keep them in the ground is ludicrous on its face. Second, let's talk about oil demand in the United States. Again, there's this assumption if we don't build the pipeline, we won't need oil, or somehow we won't need refineries. Again, that's false. Look at the latest projections from the Energy Information Administration. They estimate that motor fuel consumption in the United States will increase by 3 million barrels a day by 2035. We can hate oil, we can talk about boreal forests, we can talk about China, we can talk about a lot of things. The reality is oil is an incredibly important compound, and we need it for our economy. And if it's exported, okay, fine. We're exporting about 3 million barrels a day from U.S. refineries. What's wrong with that? That helps our balance of trade to the order of $100 million in 2011 alone, and that creates jobs. Again, I don't see the objections here.
Susan Casey Lefkowitz, let me give you a chance to respond to our caller's question as well. Go ahead.
Peter, that was a really excellent question and points that you raised. And you're right that extracting tar sands produces about three times the greenhouse gas emissions than extracting or producing conventional oil does. And when you look at that combined with the amount of energy also needed for the upgrading and refining, it's a pretty heavy burden to be putting on our climate when every day in the United States communities are experiencing now the impacts of climate change in droughts and floods and fires. 2011 was the 35th year in a row since the bicentennial in 1976 that we've had global temperatures that were above the historical average. So these are very serious considerations. And, you know, it's interesting when Robert says that the oil would just go elsewhere to Asia, for example, if we don't take it in the U.S., the truth is that right now the United States is the main customer of tar sands oil. That oil is landlocked in Alberta. There are no major pipelines to get it to any coast, which is why they want Keystone XL so badly. I'm actually in Vancouver, British Columbia right now, where this proposed pipeline would cross north of here to Kitimat, and there is such strong opposition in British Columbia, especially from the Aboriginal communities, that the pipeline and tanker traffic would go through for this proposed pipeline in British Columbia. I don't see it happening anytime soon. And the truth is that in the United States, we've been reducing our demand for oil very successfully, and fuel efficiency standards have been a big part of that. Not only have we reduced our demand for oil, but we've revitalized our automobile industry, creating jobs. And those are the kinds of jobs that we need in America, jobs that aren't putting our land and our risk and our health and our climate under the gun, but instead are actually, you know, moving us forward to the kind of energy that we need in the future.
And Robert Bryce, would it be sensible to have a policy, the goal of which is to eventually wean the United States, maybe even the world, from oil? And so far, it looks like a finite resource.
Well, the availability of any resource is dependent on the price. So at a price of $200 a barrel, for instance, there's a lot more oil that can be brought to market. Look, I understand the anti-oil sentiment, and it's been something that's been common in American political rhetoric for decades. Look at the Gallup poll done last September. Even Congress, the federal government, ranks ahead of the oil industry, oil and gas industry, in terms of favorability ratings from the public. So we can slap around the oil companies all we want, say we hate them, that's fine. The reality is the world runs on petroleum. If oil didn't exist, we would have to invent it. Let me just talk about the issue of risks of spills. There is no question that the pipelines can have leaks, and they have, and they will in the future. That said, pipelines are the safest, cheapest way to transport oil and natural gas. Always have been, and they always will be.
And that's Robert Bryce, again, Senior Fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. Also with us is Susan Casey-Lefkowitz, Director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times, giving two very different perspectives on the Keystone XL pipeline that has been in the news. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Tell us where you stand on the Keystone XL pipeline. Should it be built? Should it not? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. It's the winter membership campaign at WHYY, and think of all you get. News and information broadcast around the clock that keeps you informed and entertained. Online services and social media like Radio Times Facebook page and Newsworks. We produce 500 shows every year on Radio Times. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work by Edwige Danticat. Celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2012 with lead sponsor Walmart, the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia program features 8 inspired weeks of workshops, performances, and discussions through March 17th. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia proudly supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are debating the Keystone XL pipeline with Susan Casey, Lefkowitz, and Robert Bryce. And again, just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. This is an issue that has been in the news, a very hotly contested proposal, and we want to hear where you stand on the issue. Let me see what Jim from Willingboro has to say. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're
I'll
welcome.
Be brief. One question, but first I need to know, if Ms. Lefkowitz is correct, and this there is plenty of capacity to move this material, and the real intent is to ship it out of the country anyway, then I think that everything else is a moot point, and we've got Oz is behind the curtain again. But my question is, why can't refineries be built closer to the material?
Well, let me give Susan Casey Lefkowitz a chance to weigh in on your comment, Jim. Susan, your thoughts.
Jim, it's a really good point. And basically, in Canada, the refineries are nearing capacity. And so what has happened in Canada is that, in part, because of the tar sands expansion, labor is short and supplies are at short. You know, they can't essentially get them cheaply enough or as cheaply as they can get them in the United States. And so the oil industry has been looking to the U.S. to refine and upgrade the tar sands oil. And for a while what had happened is we had 2 new pipelines built for tar sands oil to the Midwest to bring them to the refineries there. This newest play, indeed, is to get it to the Gulf Coast so that it can, you know, be turned into diesel and exported, actually relieving the glut of tar sands oil that currently exists in our Midwest. And that's one reason why building this Keystone XL pipeline would actually cause oil prices to go up, even though that, you know, it's not what you would first think with a new pipeline, but because it would actually be taking that oil that otherwise would go to the Midwest and bring it to the Gulf Coast, where it would then go out of the country, you're looking at actually raising oil prices, all to benefit the oil companies, I might add.
Well, let me give you a chance, Robert Rice, to weigh in on that. Is that true?
Well, let's look at Ms. Casey Lefkowitz's claim there. And just on its face, think about it. Okay, so we have an increased supply, and yet prices will go up. I don't know. In my understanding of economics, you have increased supply, price goes down. The reality of the global market for oil and oil products is just that. It's global. It's increasingly global. Why aren't the refineries being built in Canada? Well, I would agree with Ms. Casey Lefkowitz that the issue for the Canadians, and I met with the Consul General of Canada in New York just a few weeks ago, they're short of capital. They don't have enough money to build all the refineries they need. They're producing more natural resources than they can consume themselves and also that they can refine into refined products. Meanwhile, the Saudis are building refineries and moving downstream. That is, they're selling, attempting to sell less crude and more gasoline, diesel fuel, because there's a higher margin there. So what I don't understand here, and what I think is a fundamentally flawed argument, is that somehow it's bad, because, of course, oil companies are bad, in the NRDC's view, apparently, that they can compete in the global marketplace. Valero, a company that would use some of this oil sands, they're investing $6 billion in capacity here in the United States, and the refineries create jobs. They create tax revenue. This idea that somehow we're going to be able to stop this pipeline, a key question, if I could just pose this one, Marty, is this. Why the attack on this pipeline and not a discussion of the global coal business? Look at the latest IEA data. Over the last 10 years, global coal consumption grew more than the combined increase of oil, natural gas, and nuclear combined. The idea that stopping this pipeline is going to make a difference in terms of global CO2 is, again, fundamentally flawed.
Well, Susan Casey Lefkowitz, let me give you a chance to respond.
When we look at sort of where we're going with our energy future, the basic fact remains that if we're going to protect our climate and we're going to protect our land and our water and our health, we need to be making better choices. And we have those cleaner choices. Robert's absolutely right when he says that we have to be looking at coal, we have to be looking at oil, we have to be looking at all of the fossil fuels that are creating the kinds of greenhouse gas emissions that are driving climate change. And NRDC does. Frankly, we look at all of the forms of dirty energy that are driving climate change, and we look at all of the forms of clean energy that are the possible solutions. One thing that we firmly believe is that you have to work on all of these different issues if you're going to basically be able to, you know, help the United States with its ingenuity and its drive and its ability to develop new industries, move ahead into a clean energy.
And we are talking about and debating the Keystone XL pipeline and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Sarah from Allentown has to say. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. It seems that Robert's only point is that this creates jobs and that it creates jobs and that it's not as bad because there are other options creating CO2 in our atmosphere. Well, the point is that we have different options to create jobs, and he's only looking at this oil resource. He's not necessarily looking at the other natural resources that we depend upon. This is going to go through the heartland of America, where the majority of our agricultural resources come from. We can see the detrimental effect of what's happening with the drought in Texas right now, not just hurting our grain crops, but hurting the cattle crops that depend upon it. I think he really needs to concentrate on what's going on. If something were to happen in the heartland, it wouldn't only hurt our agricultural products, but it would also hurt the meat that we depend upon.
Well, let me give Robert Bryce a chance to weigh in. Sarah, thanks for the call. Robert, go ahead.
You know, she made a comment, and she's welcome to it. We can move on. I've made my point.
Well, no, I don't want. Hold on 1 second. I mean, what she's talking, there are jobs and there are jobs, and she's talking about, from her perspective, the idea that these jobs associated with the XL pipeline could hurt farmers, could hurt the water supply in the Midwest of the country. And I just,
sure.
What's your answer to that?
Look, I think Matt Walt said it just exactly right, which is there is no such thing as a free lunch when it comes to energy, but there's no such thing as a free lunch when it comes to agriculture either. So this idea that are there trade-offs? Of course there are trade-offs. I'm not going to argue that point. But again, this idea that somehow, of course, if the pipeline gets built, it's going to damage our water. Of course, there's going to be a spill, and it's going to be catastrophic. Well, and Ms. Casey Lefkowitz said there had been 14 spills already in one pipeline. Okay, well, how large were they? Was it one barrel? Was it a gallon? The point is we have to have a longer-term look at our energy supplies here, and this pipeline by itself provides us with an opportunity to have a stable long-term supply of a critical commodity from our neighbor and longtime ally that I think makes perfect sense. And yet, the potential for demagoguery on it, obviously, is enormous, and that's what we're seeing.
But are you saying that she's being demagogic, Susan Casey Lefkowitz?
Well, I think, look, I've tried to present as many numbers here as I can about the scale of this project, mm-hmm. what it means in terms of the global market. I understand that she's talking about clean air, clean water, you know, all those things. I'm for those. But the reality is that we need to look at this over the long term and the ability of our economy to continue growing. And to do that, we're going to need oil. So,
The point I was trying to make is I mean, I think we're having a civil and important conversation, and I don't hear demagoguery in our conversation.
Fair enough.
Okay, fair enough. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, Robert Bryce, Senior Fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute, Susan Casey Lefkowitz, and she's Director of the International Program of the Natural Resources Defense Council, both of our guests weighing in on this Keystone XL pipeline. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Robin Bloom, and with me is Joanne Allen, listening to Marty refereeing her guest there on Radio Times. Always interesting, always informative. It's always fun to listen how gracefully Marty talks to her guests and gets them back on topic. A great hour on the Keystone Pipeline. I learned a lot. I didn't know a lot about that, but now I do know about it, and we'll be switching gears, as Marty always says, and going on to a fun topic up in the next hour.
Absolutely. In the next hour, she's going to be talking about a book called Wayward Saints by Susie Roche. It's her debut novel, and it's about Susie and her sisters, which is, you know, it's like Hannah and her sisters. Anyway, but what we're here to do is to ask you to support Marty Moskowain and the, as she just said in her discussion just then, a civil conversation is what they're having on Radio Times, and it's what you always hear on Radio Times. Now, if Marty could be here right now and explain to you what it is that she do, she would tell you that what she does is all for you as the listener. She wants to get the information to you in a way that's understandable and not what you normally hear from the chattering classes, the pundits, the people who have an axe to grind, who have a point of view. Marty is interested in letting you get the information, decipher it yourself, and then figure out what you think. She doesn't tell you what to think. That's why we love Marty Moskowain. That's why we love Radio Times. And if you want to support Marty and the show and her staff, call us at 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-9499, or go online at WHYY.org.
While you're online at WHYY.org, you can check out Radio Times' great website. Lots of information on there. The archives are there. You can listen to podcasts and find out how to become a caller, see behind the scenes, and follow them on Facebook and Twitter and all those great things. And you know, Radio Times, WHOY, we've stayed up to date with technology and media, new media, and have, you know, kept with the times. But one thing that hasn't changed, Joanne, is the quality of the programs that you hear on WHYY, like Radio Times, the kind of interviewer that Marty is. She always knows all about the topics that she's talking about, or is at least well-informed enough to ask the right questions of her guests and let us find out what's going on and think about it on our own. If you appreciate that service, give us a call at 888-345-9499. Pledge online, WHYY.org. You decide the value of this service. Membership begins at the level you decide, so give us a call right now.
And it does take dedication to put on a program such as Radio Times in the way that Marty and her staff does. 1-888-345-9499. Marty is here at like 6:37 in the morning. Her show doesn't go on till 10. I know she's been reading all night and all afternoon and making sure that she's got as much as she can possibly fit into her brain in order to hold an intelligent conversation with her guests. It's what we appreciate about Marty Moskowain here at WHYY, and I'm pretty sure that's what you appreciate about Radio Times. Call us 1-888-345-9499. It's one thing to say you enjoy the programming. It's another thing to support it. Go online at WHYY.org.
Or 888-345-9499. If you appreciate Radio Times and Marty Moskowain, as Joanne says, she knows so much, but also more than that, what I love about Marty is she's a really cool person.
Yes.
So just pledge because you really like Marty. She's great. 888-345-9499-WHYY.org. Now tonight, Joanne, is the Florida primary. We're going to be covering it here at WHYY, so be sure to stay with us for that. And coming up in April, we'll have the Delaware and Pennsylvania primaries, and in June will be New Jersey. Always keeping you informed here at WHYY, and it's the election season. We're gearing up. And
getting all jittery. You're like, oh, it's the election season.
Whoa.
Let's go.
And where are you going to be finding out about all the information you need to be prepared for November right here at WHYY and Radio Times? Marty's already doing programs about it. Yesterday she did a whole program on the GOP's presidential candidates and the state of the Republican Party. And she also last week, what Mitt Romney's tax return tells us about the U.S. tax system. A lot of information to process, but you can find it all here at WHYY. So give us a call. Show your support. 888-345-9499.
We will have live coverage of the results from the Florida primary tonight at 8 here on WHYY, and it's live special programming. What does that mean? Well, it means that we have to pay NPR a certain amount of money just normally, but when they do special programming, they expect some special money. So what do? We ask you, if you are going to listen tonight, if you've been listening to the live special coverage of all of the primaries and will continue to listen in the future, Now is the time for you to call us and let us know that you want to keep listening to such programming, because you know you're going to get the very best from NPR and WHYY. You're going to get results. You're going to get analysis. But it's not going to be over-the-top analysis. It's the kind of analysis that will make you think. 1-888-345-9499. Also, give us a ping at WHYY.org.
888-345-9499. Thanks so much for that call. And when issues are happening, elections, you'll hear about it here on Radio Times and how it impacts us locally as well as nationally. Marty and her staff, they take all the information and they process it for us, and we appreciate that. And if you appreciate it, give us a call, 888-345-9499, 888-345-WHYY, WHYY.org. Lots of benefits of membership. You get the member experience card, discounts on arts and cultural institutions across the region.
Alone, that's worth a membership pledge.
Exactly, exactly. Invitations to special events here at WHYY. And Radio Times often has events where they take Radio Times on the road, or they have Radio Times live here in the studios. You'd be invited to that. And we have Friday Arts, First Friday celebrations here at WHYY. Film screenings, children's events, you name it, performances, concerts. We have a great event coming up for Valentine's Day. A lot to offer you here at WHYY. When you go to WHYY.org, you can check out our member support page and find out all those events that you can be a part of as well when you become a member and support WHYY. So give us a call, 888-345-9499, 888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org.
It's a membership campaign. This is public broadcasting. This is public media. And with each membership campaign, we have an overall goal. For this campaign, we're looking to sign up or renew 8,000 listeners. Now, what does that mean? That means if we make our goal overall for the drive, we will be on track to make our year as great as it can be financially, because you as a listener has decided to join and to do your part. So if you're listening for the first time, maybe in one of our New Jersey stations that's new and expanded, if you have fallen away and you're kind of a lapsed member and you want to rejoin, absolutely come on board. If you want to just renew because it's that time of the year, it's been a year, so now it's time for you to sign up again, please make the call at 1-888-345-9499. Or go online and type in WHYY.org and pledge that way.
Whether you're a longtime listener, you just started, we invite you to join right now at any level. You decide the value of the service. That's what we tell you all the time. And we do appreciate any level that you do pledge. And your support directly goes to sustain programs like Radio Times, like Morning Edition, like All Things Considered, Fresh Air coming up later today, every day at 3 and 7 with